Now, after almost every presentation, someone will come up to me and ask, "What do I do when I'm lonely?" I am certainly not an expert on this topic, which in itself is intimidating. I've opened the door to a conversation I don't always feel equipped to address. But that is why Brené's work is so important. We have to have the hard conversations even when we're not ready. I always use Brené's words and tell the asker, "I'm a traveler, not a map maker. I am going down this path same as and with you." I tell everyone who shares this moment with me that I try to be very deliberate in scheduling plans, that I am very deliberate in building relationships so that when that feeling of loneliness strikes, I have someone I can reach out to. More than anything, I tell them I'm honest about the way I'm feeling and when I'm struggling. Never once before this event did an airman of mine come up to me and tell me they were lonely. By starting the conversation, I believe I've given them permission. I've conveyed that it's a safe topic to discuss. Now when they come to me, and they themselves are vulnerable, I have an opportunity to address it before their loneliness gets to a level of overwhelm, and they see no other way out. Once, when I was telling the story, another commander came up to me and said, "I talk to my folks all the time about being disconnected." I looked at her and said, "Why do you use the word disconnected? It's such a sterile word. Why not just use the word lonely?" I can't say for certain, but she appeared uncomfortable with that. I went on. If I ask an airman, "Are you feeling disconnected?" I don't feel like that airman knows that I truly see them, that I understand what it is they're going through. Because again, disconnected is a sterile word. It's a safe word. It's not a word that conveys the true depth of shared human experience, like loneliness. Whereas if I ask an airman, "Are you lonely?" I feel as if I am reaching them at a deeper level. I am letting them know in that moment I am comfortable addressing the messy parts of life and that I won't shy away from their loneliness. In a sense, I'm telling them, "Let's go there together. I am strong enough to hold this for both of us." Didi continues, "The words we use really matter. But words like loneliness, empathy, compassion are not words often discussed in our leadership training, nor are they included in our leadership literature. The Air Force's most current manual on leadership, Air Force Doctrine Document 1-1, Leadership in Force Development, was written in 2011. In the document, it explains that our Air Force's current core values are an evolution of 7 leadership traits identified in the Air Force's very first manual on leadership, Air Force Manual 35-15. Which was written in 1948. One of the 7 traits was humanness. My first reaction was, "Huh? What is humanness?" Didi says, "Intrigued and curious, I set out to find the 1948 document. Interestingly, it took me a few hours to find the 1948 manual because it was not located in any of the leadership files. It was actually buried in the historical documents of the Air Force Chaplain Corps. As I was reading the document, I was struck by how much emotion I was feeling from the words on the page. So I started to pay more attention. The pages were full of words and phrases like to belong, a sense of belonging, feeling, fear, compassion, confidence, kindness, friendliness, and mercy. I was amazed. Here's this military document that's talking about leadership with mercy and kindness and belonging and love. Yes, the word love was in the military leadership manual. I decided to do a word search for these words and phrases to see how often they were used. A discussion of feeling, how men would feel, was referred to 147 times. The importance of creating a sense of belonging was mentioned 21 times. The fear of combat, the fear of exclusion, the fear a life in the profession of arms will bring was mentioned 35 times. Love, what it means as a leader to love your men, was brought up 13 times. Didi writes, "I won't go through the entire document, but suffice it to say this document used a language that speaks to the human experience when it was instructing leaders on how to lead people." I went back to our current manual on leadership and searched for the same words. Unfortunately, such words weren't used. Over and over again, each search turned up zero. These words that address the real emotions of people have been completely removed from our language on leadership. Our most current manual on leadership uses phrases like tactical leadership, operational leadership, strategic leadership. Important concepts, no doubt. But the concepts provide little guidance to our young leaders on how to deal with the many complexities of how people, of how our airmen, process the experience of being in the military during a time of war. In sanitizing our language, I think we've decreased our comfort with expressing those feelings and holding that same space for others. I'm comfortable using a word like lonely, a sometimes awkward and uncomfortable feeling and word for us to talk about, because I'm willing to sit in that discomfort and give them permission to be in it with me. When I first started learning from Brené's work and talking about it, specifically the power of vulnerability in leadership, people would look at me like I was crazy. I realized then I wasn't going to be able to talk about it on a large scale, so I decided I would start small, and I would use her work with just my 6 squadron commanders. I felt that if I did nothing more than help these 6 people become leaders with different tools to navigate the challenges of leadership, then I would have done enough. With these 6 leaders, we have dug in, and because of that, there have been a million moments where Brené's work has changed the way we're leading people. Again, I'm just going to have to close this piece by saying I think Dee Dee is just an absolutely heroic leader. And if you heard either Dee Dee's story or the story about how my team and I work through our rumble and think, wow, this is way too kumbaya, ask yourself if you're underestimating the courage these types of conversations take, or are you maybe diminishing the effort so you don't have to give it a shot? If you heard these stories and you think, I'm not sure I could ever do this work with my team, I have a suggestion. Grab a copy of the book. Make copies of this section. Ask your team to read it, then bring them together for 45 minutes. Ask questions. What did you think? Would putting any of this language or these tools into practice be helpful for us? If so, what would we need to do it? This is a great opportunity for container building. If the team thinks there's nothing helpful here, ask why not. This is a daring opportunity to surface fears, feelings, and stealth expectations and intentions, or just to hear better ideas. If you heard these stories and you're thinking, who has the time? I'd ask you to calculate the cost of distrust and disconnection in terms of productivity, performance, and engagement. Here's what I know to be true from my experience and what I consider to be one of the most important learnings from this research. Leaders must either invest a reasonable amount of time attending to fears and feelings, or squander an unreasonable amount of time trying to manage ineffective and unproductive behavior. What this means is that we must find the courage to get curious and possibly surface emotions and emotional experiences that people can't articulate or that might be happening outside of their awareness. If we find ourselves addressing the same problematic behaviors over and over, we may need to dig deeper to the thinking and feeling driving those behaviors. After the 3rd one-on-one addressing the same issue, it's easy to make up a story that this person is just being difficult or testing us. But what I found in my own experience is that we haven't gone deep enough. We haven't peeled away enough layers of the onion. And once we start peeling, we have to leave long enough pauses and empty space. I know the conversation is hard enough, but people need white space. Stop talking. Even if it's awkward, which it will be for like the first 15 times. And when they start talking, which they normally will, listen. Really listen. Don't formulate your response while they're talking. If you have a great insight, hold it. Don't do that thing where the listener starts nodding faster and faster, not because they're actively listening, but because they're trying to unconsciously signal the talker to wrap it up so they can talk. Keep a lot of space in the conversation. Another thing, when we're in tough rumbles with people, we can't take responsibility for their emotions. They're allowed to be pissed or sad or surprised or elated. But if their behaviors are not okay, we set the boundaries. For example, look, I know this is a tough conversation. Being angry is okay. Yelling, that's not okay. Or, I know we're tired and stressed. This has been a long meeting. Being frustrated is okay. interrupting people and rolling your eyes, not okay. Or, I appreciate the passion around these different opinions and ideas. The emotion is okay, but passive-aggressive comments and put-downs are not okay. Also, don't forget one of our favorite Rumble tools, the timeout. When rumbles become unproductive, call a timeout. Give everyone 10 minutes to walk around outside or catch their breath. In our organization, everyone is empowered to call a timeout, and we all do it when we need it. Sometimes a team member will say, I need time to think about what I'm hearing. Can we take an hour and circle back after lunch? I really appreciate that because it leads to better decision making. And giving people a reasonable amount of thinking time cuts down on the meeting after the meeting and back channeling behaviors, which are both outside of what's okay in our culture. Just remember, we can't do our jobs when we own other people's emotions or take responsibility for them as a way to control the related behaviors. For one simple reason. Other people's emotions are not our jobs. We can't both serve people and try to control their feelings. Daring leadership is ultimately about serving other people, not ourselves. That's why we choose courage. Section 3, The Armory. A quote from Manoush Shafiq, director, the London School of Economics. In the past, jobs were about muscles. Now they're about brains. But in the future, they'll be about the heart. So I have a 13-year-old son, which means I have seen every spy thriller and Marvel movie ever made, Black Panther and Guardians of the Galaxy, at least 3 times. When I think about how and why we self-protect against vulnerability, I picture those movie scenes where, even after penetrating the heavily fortified perimeter, you find that there are 10 more obstacles to navigate to get to the treasure. You've got the infrared security beams, floors that drop out beneath you, hidden traps, and of course, you have the fake contact lens so you can get past the retina scan. Once you shimmy, leap, and fight your way past all of these impossible hurdles, the Holy Grail is within reach. After all these Herculean power moves, the camera zooms in to show the small, unassuming stone that holds within it all the power in the world, or the magical elixir that grants its owner immortality. At the center of all of our elaborate personal security measures and protection schemes lies the most precious treasure of the human experience, the heart. In addition to serving as the life-giving muscle that keeps blood pumping through our body, it's the universal metaphor for our capacity to love and be loved. And it's the symbolic gateway to our emotional lives. I've always talked about living with an unarmored heart as wholeheartedness. In The Gifts of Imperfection, I define wholeheartedness as engaging in our lives from a place of worthiness, cultivating the courage, compassion, and connection to wake up in the morning and think, no matter what gets done and how much is left undone, I am enough. It's going to bed at night and thinking, yes, I'm imperfect and vulnerable and sometimes afraid, but that doesn't change the truth that I am brave and worthy of love and belonging. Wholeheartedness captures the essence of a fully examined emotional life and a liberated heart, one that is free and vulnerable enough to love and be loved, and a heart that is equally free and vulnerable to be broken and hurt. Rather than protecting and hiding our heart behind bulletproof glass, wholeheartedness is about integration. It's integrating our thinking, feeling, and behavior. It's putting down the armor and bringing forth all of the scraggly, misshapen pieces of our history and folding in all of the different roles that, when falsely separated, keep us feeling exhausted and torn to make a complex, messy, awesome whole person. I love that the Latin root of the word integrate is integrare, to make whole. Today, we pay a lot of lip service to the idea of bringing your whole self to work. Yet the organizations that actually allow employees to do that are few and far between. I don't see a tremendous amount of meaningful, actionable support for integration and wholeheartedness in most companies. The slogan is easy. The behaviors to support the slogan are not. There are definitely some companies that embrace wholeheartedness, but what I often observe is that many organizational cultures and leaders still subscribe to the myth that if we sever the heart, vulnerability and other emotions, from our work, we'll be more productive, efficient, and, don't forget, easier to manage. Or, at the very least, we'll be less messy and less, well, human. These beliefs lead us to consciously or unconsciously build cultures that require and reward armor. In teams and organizations where heart and emotion, especially vulnerability, are seen as liabilities, the culture, or in some cases individual leaders, strike a bargain with our grifter egos to lock up the heart and seal off the feelings. They reward armor like perfectionism, emotional stoicism, the false compartmentalizing of our lives and our work, keeping things easy and comfortable instead of embracing the necessary tough and awkward conversations. And they value all knowing over always learning and staying curious. The problem is that when we imprison the heart, we kill courage. In the same way that we depend on our physical heart to pump life-giving blood to every part of our body, we depend on our emotional heart to keep vulnerability coursing through the veins of courage and to engage all of the behaviors we talked about in the prior section, including trust, innovation, creativity, and accountability. And when we become disembodied from our emotions to the point that we literally don't recognize which physical feelings are connected to which emotional feelings, we don't gain control. We lose it. Without our understanding or consent, emotions start driving our decision-making and behavior, while thinking is tied up in the trunk. On the other hand, when the heart is open and free and we're connected to our emotions and understand what they're telling us, new worlds open up for us, including better decision-making and critical thinking, and the powerful experiences of empathy, self-compassion, and resilience. Ego is an eager and willing conspirator when it comes to locking away the heart. I think of my ego as my inner hustler. It's that voice in my head that drives pretending, performing, pleasing, and perfecting. The ego loves gold stars and craves acceptance and approval. It has no interest in wholeheartedness, just self-protection and admiration. Our ego will do almost anything to avoid or minimize the discomfort associated with feeling vulnerable or even being curious, because it's too risky. What will people think? What if I learn something unpleasant or uncomfortable about myself? While the ego is powerful and demanding, it's just a tiny part of who we are. The heart is giant by comparison, and it's free. Wholehearted wisdom can drown out the smallness of needing to be liked. I love how Jungian analyst Jim Hollis describes the ego as that thin wafer of consciousness floating on an iridescent ocean called the soul. Hollis writes, "We are not here to fit in, be well balanced, or provide exempla for others. We are here to be eccentric, different, perhaps strange, perhaps merely to add our small piece, our little clunky, chunky selves, to the great mosaic of being. As the gods intended, we are here to become more and more ourselves." Protecting our ego and fitting in is why we reach for armor in situations where we think being liked or respected is at risk because we may be wrong or not have all the answers, or might get in over our heads and not look smart enough. We also go on lockdown when our emotions may be perceived by others in a way that we can't manage or control. Well, if I'm honest about how I'm feeling, will I be misunderstood? Will I be judged? Will I be seen as weak? Will my vulnerability change the way you think of me or my ability? All of these situations lead to the biggest threat to our ego and our sense of self-worth, shame. Shame is the feeling that washes over us and makes us feel so flawed that we question whether we're worthy of love, belonging, and connection. It's such a powerful experience and so potentially debilitating that I'll spend the next section walking us through shame and its antidote, empathy. But back to the armory. The irony across all self-protection is that at the same time as we're worrying about machine learning and artificial intelligence, taking jobs and dehumanizing work, we are intentionally or unintentionally creating cultures that, instead of leveraging the unique gifts of the human heart, like vulnerability, empathy, and emotional literacy, we're trying to lock those gifts away. There are some things that machines and algorithms do better than us for the simple reason of computing power, quicker elimination of variables that humans either don't see or won't dismiss for some reason, and the fact that machines have no ego. They don't need to be right to self-protect. They don't defend or rationalize. They simply recalculate and recalibrate in an instant. The hopeful news is that there are some tasks that humans will always be able to do better than machines if we are willing to take off our armor and leverage our greatest and most unique asset, the human heart. Those of us who are willing to rumble with vulnerability, live into our values, build trust, and learn to reset will not be threatened by the rise of the machines, because we'll be a part of the rise of daring leaders. To start this section on the vulnerability armory, I want to read you a quote from Daring Greatly. As children, we found ways to protect ourselves from vulnerability, from being hurt, diminished, and disappointed. We put on armor. We used our thoughts, emotions, and behaviors as weapons. And we learned how to make ourselves scarce, even to disappear. Now, as adults, we realize that to live with courage, purpose, and connection, to be the person who we long to be, we must again be vulnerable. We must take off the armor, put down the weapons, show up, and let ourselves be seen. So this entire section is dedicated to talking to you about what we found in the research. 16 specific examples of armored leadership that emerged from the data, along with the daring leadership response to each. I'm going to define each type of armor and then dig in to what it means to dare to lead. How do we put down that armor, and how do we inspire the people on our teams to do the same? I want to start by just giving you a quick read of the overview of the 16 forms of armored leadership and the 16 forms of daring leadership. So let's start there. Number one, armored leadership is driving perfectionism and fostering fear of failure. The daring leadership response, modeling and encouraging healthy striving, empathy, and self-compassion. Armored leadership is working from scarcity and squandering opportunities for joy and recognition. The daring leadership response is practicing gratitude and celebrating milestones and victories. The armored leadership approach is numbing. The daring leadership response is setting boundaries and, rather than numbing, finding real comfort. Number four, the armored leadership approach is propagating the false dichotomy of victim or Viking, crush or be crushed. The daring leadership response is practicing integration, strong back, soft front, wild heart. Number five, and this is a big one, the armored leadership response is always being a knower and being right. The daring leadership response is being a learner and getting it right. Armored leadership, hiding behind cynicism. Daring leadership, modeling clarity, kindness, and hope. Number seven, the armored leadership approach, using criticism as self-protection. The daring leadership approach, making contributions and taking risks. Number eight, armored leadership is about using power over people. Daring leadership is about using power with, power to, and power within. Number nine, armored leadership leaves us hustling for our worth. Daring leadership is knowing our value. Number 10, armored leadership leading for compliance and control, where daring leadership is cultivating commitment and shared purpose. Number 11, the armored leadership approach is weaponizing fear and uncertainty. But the daring leadership approach is acknowledging, naming, and normalizing collective fear and uncertainty. Number 12, armored leadership is about rewarding exhaustion as a status symbol and attaching productivity to self-worth. Daring leadership is about modeling and supporting rest, play, and recovery. Armored leadership, tolerating discrimination, echo chambers, and a fitting in culture. But daring leadership, cultivating a culture of belonging, inclusivity, and diverse perspectives. In armored leadership, we collect gold stars. In daring leadership, we give gold stars. Number 15, armored leadership is about zigzagging and avoiding. But daring leadership is about straight talking and taking action. And then last, number 16, armored leadership is about leading from hurt, where daring leadership is about leading from heart. So now we're going to dig into each one of these 16 pairs and take them apart a little bit and talk about how they drive behaviors and how they drive how we want to show up at work. The first three, perfectionism, foreboding, joy, and numbing, were the top forms of armor in the original research we did on vulnerability, which I published in Daring Greatly, and they made it onto this list as well. The remaining 13 emerged as the most common forms of self-protection that we see in organizations. However, I will say that I find that they have a major application across my life and probably will in yours as well. Okay, let's start with number one. Armored leadership, driving perfectionism, and fostering fear of failure. The daring leadership response, modeling and encouraging healthy striving, empathy, and self-compassion. For obvious reasons, I've been writing about perfectionism for as long as I've been writing. Researcher, heal thyself. There are also some not so obvious reasons. As a shame researcher, I've learned that wherever perfectionism is driving us, shame is riding shotgun. Like vulnerability, perfectionism is surrounded by mythology. Here's what I've learned over the years and shared in some of my other work. Let's get started with what perfectionism is not. Perfectionism is not the same thing as striving for excellence. Perfectionism is not about healthy achievement and growth. Perfectionism is a defensive move. Perfectionism is not the self-protection we think it is. It is a 20-ton shield that we lug around thinking it will protect us when in fact it's the thing that really prevents us from being seen. Perfectionism is not self-improvement. Perfectionism is, at its core, about trying to earn approval. Most perfectionists grew up being praised for achievement and performance. Grades, manners, rule-following, people-pleasing, appearance, sports. Somewhere along the way, they adopted this dangerous and debilitating belief system. I am what I accomplish and how well I accomplish it. Please perform, perfect, prove. Healthy striving is self-focused. How can I improve? Perfectionism is other-focused. What will people think? Perfectionism is a hustle. Perfectionism is not the key to success. In fact, research shows that perfectionism hampers achievement. Perfectionism is correlated with depression, anxiety, addiction, and life paralysis or missed opportunities. The fear of failing, making mistakes, not meeting people's expectations, and being criticized keeps us outside the arena where healthy competition and striving unfolds. Last, perfectionism is not a way to avoid shame. Perfectionism is a function of shame. Here's how I define perfectionism. Perfectionism is a self-destructive and addictive belief system that fuels this primary thought. If I look perfect and do everything perfectly, I can avoid or minimize the painful feelings of blame, judgment, and shame. Perfectionism is self-destructive simply because perfection doesn't exist. It's an unattainable goal. Perfectionism is more about perception than internal motivation, and there is no way to control perception, no matter how much time and energy we spend trying. Perfectionism is addictive because when we invariably do experience shame, judgment, and blame, we often believe it's because we weren't perfect enough. Rather than questioning the faulty logic of perfectionism, we become even more entrenched in our quest to look and do everything just right. Perfectionism actually sets us up to feel shame, judgment, and blame, which then leads to even more shame and self-blame. It's my fault. I'm feeling this way because I'm not good enough. The daring leadership response to perfectionism is modeling and encouraging healthy striving, empathy, and self-compassion. Conversations about perfectionism within trusting and brave teams can be healing and powerful. The goal is to get very clear about where, as a team, we're the most likely to get swallowed by perfectionism, how it shows up, and how we distinguish perfectionism from healthy striving for excellence. Are there ways that we can check in with one another that work for everyone? Are there flags, warning signs, or indicator lights that we can all take responsibility for spotting? I've seen teams that are willing to have these conversations, make profound changes, grow closer, increase their performance, and build trust in the process. Number two, armored leadership is working from scarcity and squandering opportunities for joy and recognition. Daring leadership is practicing gratitude and celebrating milestones and victories. When I'm speaking to big groups, I always ask, when something great happens in your life, how many of you start to celebrate only to find yourself thinking, don't get too happy. That's just inviting disaster. Arms fly up. You got promoted. You're really excited. You got engaged. You found out that you're pregnant. You found out you're going to be a grandparent. Something wonderful happens. And for a brief second, you let the joy wash over you. And then 5 seconds later, the excitement is gone and you're panicked about a bad thing that's going to happen to counter the positive. When is the other shoe going to drop? For parents listening to this, how many of you have stood over your child while they're sleeping and thought, oh God, I love this kid more than I knew was possible. And in that same second, felt fear wash over you and pictured something horrible happening to your child. Statistically, it's about 90% of us. Why do we insist on dress rehearsing tragedy in moments of deep joy? Because joy is the most vulnerable emotion we feel. And that's saying something, given that I study fear and shame. When we feel joy, it is a place of incredible vulnerability. It's beauty and fragility and deep gratitude and impermanence, all wrapped up in one experience. When we can't tolerate that level of vulnerability, joy actually becomes foreboding, and we immediately move to self-protection. It's as if we grab vulnerability by the shoulders and say, you will not catch me off guard. You will not sucker punch me with pain. I will be prepared and ready for you. So when something joyful happens, we start planning on being hurt. We start planning to deal with the fear of disappointment. Is this helpful? Of course not. We cannot plan for painful moments. We know this for a fact because people who have been forced to live through those moments tell us that there is no amount of catastrophizing or planning for disaster that prepares you for them. The collateral damage of this instinct is that we squander the joy we need to build up an emotional reserve, the joy that allows us to build up resilience for when tragic things do happen. At work, foreboding joy shows up in more subtle ways. It shows up by making us hesitant to celebrate victories for two primary reasons. The first is that we're afraid if we celebrate with our team or have a moment where we just breathe, we're inviting disaster and something will go wrong. You can likely identify with that feeling of getting a project up and out the door and then refusing to celebrate it with high fives because you think, we can't celebrate right now because we don't know if it's going to be perfect. We don't know if it's going to work. We don't know if the site will stay up. The second way foreboding joy shows up at work is withholding recognition. We don't want our employees to get too excited because there's still so much work to be done. We don't want them to take their foot off the gas, to get complacent. So we don't celebrate achievements. We think we'll do it someday. But these same factors persist in the wake of joy. This is how foreboding joy shows up at the office, and it's a costly mistake. The daring leadership response to working from scarcity and squandering joy is practicing gratitude and celebrating milestones and victories. What is the one thing that people who can fully lean into joy have in common? Gratitude. They practice gratitude. It's not an attitude of gratitude. It's an actual practice. They keep a journal or make a note of what they're grateful for on their phones or share it with their family members. From the day the finding about gratitude emerged from the data, our family put it into practice at the dinner table. Now, after we sing grace, summer camp style, we each share one specific instance of gratitude with the table. It's changed us, and it's given us an invaluable window into our kids' lives and hearts. Embodying and practicing gratitude changes everything. It is not a personal construct. It's a human construct, a unifying part of our existence. And it's the antidote to foreboding joy, plain and simple. It's allowing yourself the pleasure of accomplishment or love or joy, of really feeling it, of basking in it, by conjuring up gratitude for the moment and for the opportunity. It's allowing yourself to recognize the shiver of vulnerability that, oh shit, I have something worth losing now, feeling. And to just sit with it and be grateful that you have something you want in your hand that it feels good to hold and recognize. Something as simple as starting or ending meetings with a gratitude check, when everyone shares one thing they're grateful for, can build trust and connection, can serve as container building, and it gives your group permission to lean into joy. Earlier this year, I gave the opening keynote address at WorkHuman, an HR conference put on by Globoforce, a provider of recognition programs and solutions. I said yes to the invitation to speak because recognition has emerged from our Daring Leadership data as essential to developing brave leaders and courage cultures. I had read several articles that show recognition is a factor in increasing employee engagement, satisfaction, and retention in an increasingly competitive global talent market. But I hadn't read any case studies, so I jumped into some of the leader and peer recognition work that Globalforce has been doing. Globalforce worked with Cisco to use recognition to boost employee engagement by 5%, and with Intuit to achieve and sustain a double-digit increase in employee engagement over a large employee base that spans 6 countries. Hershey's recognition approach helped increase employee satisfaction by 11%. And for LinkedIn, retention rates are nearly 10 percentage points higher for new hires who are recognized 4 or more times. Whether we're leading a group or a member of the team, whether we're working in a formal or informal recognition program, it's our responsibility to say to the people who work alongside us, we've got to stop and celebrate one another and our victories, no matter how small. Yes, there's more work to be done, and things could go sideways in an hour. But that will not take away from the fact that we need to celebrate an accomplishment right now. Number 3, the armored leadership is numbing. The daring leadership response is setting boundaries and finding real comfort. We all numb. We all have different numbing agents of choice. Food, work, social media, shopping, television, video games, porn, booze. From beer in a brown paper bag to the socially acceptable but equally dangerous fine wine hobby. But we all do it. And when we chronically and compulsively turn to these numbing agents, it's addiction, not just taking the edge off. Statistically, every person listening to this book is affected by addiction. If it's not you, then it could be a friend, colleague, or family member. No matter who or how, if you're paying attention, you've had a front row seat to the pain, the suffering, and the costs. According to the National Council on Alcoholism and Drug Dependence, 70% of the estimated 14.8 million Americans who use illegal drugs are employed, and drug abuse costs employers $81 billion annually. There is no us and them when it comes to numbing. We all do it. The question is to what degree? And when we're talking about the pain surrounding addiction, it's never a self-contained storm. It's a tornado. Numbing or taking the edge off doesn't have the same consequences as addiction, but they are nonetheless severe and life-altering for one reason. We cannot selectively numb emotion. If we numb the dark, we numb the light. If we take the edge off pain and discomfort, we are, by default, taking the edge off joy, love, belonging, and the other emotions that give meaning to our lives. Think of hard emotions as thorns with very sharp points. When they prick us, they cause discomfort, even pain. Just the anticipation or fear of these feelings can trigger intolerable levels of vulnerability in us. We know it's coming. For many of us, the first response to the vulnerability and discomfort of these sharp points is not to lean into the discomfort and feel our way through, but to make it go away. We do that by numbing and taking the edge off pain with whatever provides the quickest relief. Again, we can anesthetize with a whole bunch of stuff, including alcohol, drugs, food, sex, relationships, money, work, caretaking, gambling, staying busy, affairs, chaos, shopping, planning, perfectionism, constant change, the internet. I've been sober for over 20 years, and I've always struggled to figure out where I fit into the recovery system. We're almost back to the Berenstain Bears. Nothing fit quite right. I wasn't quite drunk enough for the old timers at AA. The OA people sent me to a meeting on codependency, and there they said I needed to start with AA. I wanted to take the frustrating process as a sign that I was just fine and to celebrate with a few beers, but I knew better. My life was out of control, and a family history exercise during my final month of grad school was an unexpected addiction shit show, so I asked a friend to take me to a meeting. Two meetings in, my first sponsor said, "You have the poo-poo platter of addictions, a little bit of everything. Just to be safe, it would be best if you quit drinking, smoking, comfort eating, and getting in your family's business." Awesome, I thought. I'll definitely have some free time for meetings. I never really found my meeting, but I did quit drinking and smoking the day after I finished my master's degree on May 12, 1996, and I haven't touched alcohol or tobacco since. Confession? I still fantasize about smoking when I'm driving and Bob Seger or the Rolling Stones come on. If you see me holding a pen like a cigarette driving down the road, know that there's something really great on the radio. I ultimately worked the AA program for a year, and let me just tell you, all the slogans are true. It does kind of look like a Saturday Night Live skit when you walk in and there are 10 posters hanging in a row on a wood-paneled wall in a church basement. But they're the damn truth, and if you live by them, they will rock your world. A friend of mine, who's also in recovery, said, "Leave it to a bunch of drunks in recovery to unlock the secrets of life. Among them, wherever you go, there you are. You're only as sick as your secrets. Easy does it. One day at a time. Live and let live. To thine own self be true. Halt. Don't get too hungry, angry, lonely, or tired. Let go and let God." I knew I was in trouble when my therapist reminded me that this saying is not "let go and let Brené." Ouch. The daring leadership response to numbing is setting boundaries and finding real comfort. Our research shows that participants named vulnerability, resentment, and anxiety as the biggest drivers of numbing, and resentment is almost always related to a lack of boundaries. We're knee-high in vulnerability right now, and we'll dig into anxiety in a later section. Then the relationship between resentment and boundaries in the part on trust building. For now, stay on the lookout for resentment in your life. When you're into hour three on Facebook, when you're about to finish off the entire pint of Ben & Jerry's, or when you've just spent most of your paycheck online shopping. The bottom line, like most of you, I wasn't raised with the skills and emotional practice needed to rumble with vulnerability. So I resorted to numbing. Over time, I basically became an anything-to-take-the-edge-off-aholic. But there are no specific programs for that, so I cobbled together a plan of meetings, a great therapist, and new spiritual practices that work for me. In the end, the cure for numbing is developing tools and practices that allow you to lean into discomfort and renew your spirit. First, when we're feeling that edge, instead of asking ourselves, "What's the quickest way to make these feelings go away?" ask, "What are these feelings and where did they come from?" Second, figure out what brings you real comfort and renewal, not just numbing. We deserve real comfort. The author Jennifer Loudon calls our numbing devices shadow comforts. When we're anxious, disconnected, vulnerable, alone, and feeling helpless, booze and food and work and binge-watching endless hours of TV feel like comfort. But in reality, they're only casting their long shadows over our lives. Loudon writes, "Shadow comforts can take any form. It's not what you do. It's why you do it that makes the difference. You can eat a piece of chocolate as a holy wafer of sweetness, a real comfort. Or you can cram an entire chocolate bar into your mouth without even tasting it in a frantic attempt to soothe yourself, a shadow comfort. You can chat on message boards for half an hour and be energized by the community and ready to go back to work. Or you can chat on message boards because you're avoiding talking to your partner about how angry he or she made you last night. What emerged from our data on numbing was exactly what Loudon speaks to. It's not what you do, it's why you do it that makes the difference. The invitation is to think about the intention behind our numbing choices and, if helpful, to discuss these issues with family, close friends, or a helping professional. Curbing comfort eating is a lifelong project for me, but I still work the steps and keep the posters hanging in the church basement of my mind. One of my most important self-care behaviors is my daily walking routine. So one tangible thing I do to avoid numbing with food is keep a Polaroid picture of my walking shoes in the pantry. Am I actually hungry, or would a walk bring me more real comfort? I've also spent over a decade working on setting and maintaining appropriate boundaries, especially with regard to my overachiever role as family caretaker. I may never get my Six Sigma project management certification, but I've earned a black belt in boundaries. Funny story. Apparently, my secret nickname with one of our external partners was BB, not for my name, but for Boundaries Brown. When they learned that the secret was out and I knew about the nickname, they were embarrassed and apologetic. My reply, no apologies necessary. Best compliment of my life. At work, we need to support healthy rumbles with vulnerability, to respect boundaries, and to practice calm in the sea of anxiety. And when it comes to addiction, employers with successful employee assistance programs report improvements in morale and productivity and decreases in absenteeism, accidents, downtime, turnover, and theft. Employers with long-standing programs also report better health status among employees and family members. Our fourth topic to take on in armored leadership is propagating the false dichotomy of victim or Viking, crush or be crushed, and understand how daring leadership is about practicing integration, strong back, soft front, wild heart. Winner or loser, survive or die, kill or be killed, strong or weak, leaders or followers, success or failure, crush or be crushed. Sound familiar? This is the philosophy of people who subscribe to the paradigm of victim or Viking. In this binary world of paired opposites, you're either a sucker or a loser who always gets the short end of the stick, or you're a Viking who refuses to be victimized. You'll do whatever is required, control, dominate, exert power, shut down emotion, to ensure that you're never vulnerable. This win-lose-zero-sum power dynamic is pervasive in some professions. But it's also attributable to how people were raised. If it was your primary model growing up, you're liable to believe in a false and extreme dichotomy, that if you don't do the crushing, you won't survive. When I interview people who operate from a victim or Viking perspective, I often ask them to define success. While survival or winning may mean success in some contexts, when you strip away real threat, survival is not living. We all need to belong, and we all need love. And neither is possible without vulnerability and integration. So the daring leadership response to the armor of victim or Viking is practicing integration, strong back, soft front, wild heart. The opposite of living in a world of false binaries is practicing integration, the act of bringing together all the parts of ourselves, as we talked about earlier. We are all tough and tender, scared and brave, grace and grit. The most powerful example of integration, a practice that I wrote about in Braving the Wilderness and that I try to live by, is strong back, soft front, wild heart. Here's what my teacher, Roshi Joan Halifax, says about the integration of strong back and soft front. All too often, our so-called strength comes from fear, not love. Instead of having a strong back, many of us have a defended front, shielding a weak spine. In other words, we walk around brittle and defensive, trying to conceal our lack of confidence. If we strengthen our backs, metaphorically speaking, and develop a spine that's flexible but sturdy, then we can risk having a front that's soft and open. How can we give and accept care with strong back, soft front compassion, moving past fear into a place of genuine tenderness? I believe it comes about when we can be truly transparent, seeing the world clearly, and letting the world see into us. I love that quote. And for me, that strong back is grounded confidence and boundaries. The soft front is staying vulnerable and curious. The mark of a wild heart is living out these paradoxes in our lives and not giving into the either-or BS that reduces us. It's showing up in our vulnerability and courage. And above all else, being both fierce and kind. Our next exploration in the armory is about a leadership style of being a knower and always being right versus daring leadership, which is being a learner and getting it right. Having to be the knower or always being right is heavy armor. It's defensiveness, it's posturing, and worst of all, it's a huge driver of bullshit. It's also very common. Most of us have some degree of knower in us. Too often we stereotype the knower as the irritating but lovable Cliff Clavin from the TV show Cheers. Unfortunately, needing to know everything is pretty miserable for the knowers and everyone around them. It leads to distrust, bad decisions, unnecessary rumbles, and unproductive conflict. It sounds pretty easy to replace the armor of knowing with becoming a curious learner, but for many people, the need to be a knower is driven by shame, and for some, even trauma. Being the knower can save people in hard situations, and it's easy to buy into the belief that being a knower is the only value we bring to relationships and work. Knowing can also become a culture problem, when only some people are valued as knowers. Others don't speak up because they're not senior enough or it's not their place. One leader shared that he had been with his new company for 6 months and had never contributed in a meeting. The irony is that he was brought in because of his 20-plus years of experience. And yet he was expected to be quiet in the meetings because of cultural norms that valued only the contribution of tenured leaders. The way we deal with the armored leadership of being a knower and being right is we become a learner and we concentrate on not being right, but getting it right. There are three strategies that I've seen work to transform always knowing into always learning. First, name the issue. It is a tough conversation, but clear as kind. It's a conversation that may sound like this. I'd like for you to work on your curiosity and critical thinking skills. You're often quick with answers, which can be helpful, but not as helpful as having the right questions, which is how you'll grow as a leader. We can work on this together. Knowers often have a lot of people talking behind their backs, and that's unkind. Second, make learning curiosity skills a priority. Third, acknowledge and reward great questions and instances of, I don't know, but I'd like to find out, as daring leadership behaviors. The big shift here is from wanting to be right to wanting to get it right. After these sections on rumbling with vulnerability, we're going to break down the skills and tools for curiosity and learning. Our sixth form of armored leadership is hiding behind cynicism, which we're going to counter with modeling clarity, kindness, and hope. Cynicism and sarcasm are first cousins who hang out in the cheap seats, but don't underestimate them. They often leave a trail of hurt feelings, anger, confusion, and resentment in their wake. I've seen them bring down relationships, teams, and cultures when modeled by people at the highest levels and or left unchecked. Like most hurtful comments and passive aggressiveness, cynicism and sarcasm are bad in person and even worse when they travel through email or text. And in global teams, culture and language differences make them toxic. I mean, the word sarcasm is from the Greek word sarkasian, meaning to tear flesh. Tear flesh. In a world roiled by incessant and tumultuous change, swamped by boatloads of fear and anxiety and rampant feelings of scarcity, cynicism and sarcasm are easy and cheap. In fact, I'd say they're worse than armor. We use cynicism and sarcasm as get-out-of-contributing free cards. So the daring leadership response to hiding behind cynicism is modeling clarity, kindness, and hope. This is a threefold process. Number one, stay clear and kind. Number two, practice the courage to say what you mean and mean what you say. Cynicism and sarcasm often mask anger, fear, feelings of inadequacy, and even despair. They're a safe way for us to send out an emotional trial balloon, and if it doesn't go well, we make it a joke and make you feel stupid for even thinking it was something different. Number three, if what's under cynicism and sarcasm is despair, the antidote is cultivating hope. According to the research of C.R. Schneider, hope isn't a warm and fuzzy feeling. He actually defines hope as a cognitive behavioral process that has three parts. This is a process that most of us, if we're lucky, are taught growing up, though it can be learned at any time. The three parts are goal, pathway, and agency. First, we can identify a realistic goal. I know where I want to go. And then we can figure out the pathway to get there, even if it's not a straight line and involves a plan B and some scrappiness. I know how to get there because I'm persistent, and I will keep trying in the face of setbacks and disappointment. Last is agency, the belief in our ability to stay on that path until we've arrived. I know I can do this. Again, the cynic might argue that someone who clings to hope is a sucker or ridiculously earnest. This type of armor typically comes from pain. Often, people's cynicism is related to despair. As the theologian Rob Bell explains, despair is the belief that tomorrow will be just like today. That is a devastating line. The problem with cynicism and sarcasm is that they are typically system and culture-wide. It's just so easy to take shots at other people. As brave leaders, it is essential not to reward or allow it. Reward clarity and kindness and real conversation, and teach hope instead. Number 7 in armored leadership is using criticism as self-protection. The daring leadership response is making contributions and taking risks. As Roosevelt said, it's not the critic who counts, not the man who points out how the strong man stumbles or where the doer of deeds could have done them better. Open, honest discussion, in which everyone feels free to offer suggestions and contribute, stimulates creativity. But innovation is hindered by allowing criticism from the cheap seats, from those who are not willing to get down into the arena. There are two forms of criticism that can be a little harder to recognize, nostalgia and the invisible army. Sometimes when a new idea hits the table, the knee-jerk reaction is, that's not how we do it, or we've never done it that way. People use history to criticize different thinking. We can also use the invisible army. We don't want to change course. We don't like the direction you're taking the project. I hate the invisible army. And if you use it with me, I will drill you down on exactly who makes up your we. On more than one occasion, Chaz has had to stop me from saying, what, you got a mouse in your pocket? Voicing and owning your concern is brave. Pretending that we represent a lot of folks when we don't is cheap seat behavior. Criticism often arises from fear or feelings of unworthiness. Criticism shifts the spotlight off us and onto someone or something else. Suddenly, we feel safer and better than. The daring leadership response to using criticism as self-protection is actually making contributions and taking risks. At the end of the day, at the end of the week, at the end of my life, I want to say I contributed more than I criticized. It's that simple. If you find yourself leading a team or culture in which criticism outweighs contribution, make a conscious and resolute decision to stop rewarding the former. In fact, turn contribution into a rumble skill. In our company, you're not allowed to criticize without offering a point of view in return. If you're going to tear something down, you have to offer a specific plan for how you would rebuild it to make it stronger and more substantial. In fact, even if there's nothing to criticize, we still require everyone who comes into a meeting to come with a prepared point of view and then share it. This supercharges contribution and puts everyone into the arena where the stakes are high. Your point of view can shift as new data emerge, but you still have to participate and risk a little dirt and blood on your face. The people who count are the people who are putting themselves out there and making contributions. The next form of armored leadership that we're going to take a look at, number 8 on our list, is using power over versus daring leadership, which is using power with, power to, and power within. In a 1968 speech given to striking sanitation workers in Memphis, Reverend Martin Luther King Jr. defined power as the ability to achieve purpose and effect change. This is the most accurate and important definition of power that I've ever seen. The definition doesn't make the nature of power inherently good or bad, which aligns with what I've learned in my work. Power is just the ability to achieve purpose and effect change. What makes power dangerous is how it's used. Organizational life is inherently hierarchical, with very few exceptions. Those at the top hold the majority of power, thanks to their proximity to the ultimate power holder, the CEO, the founder, the president, or the board. The higher up you are, the more likely you are to have access to the meetings behind closed doors, the private spaces where the biggest decisions are discussed and made. Hierarchy can work, except when those in leadership positions hold power over others, when their decisions benefit the minority and oppress the majority. What's perhaps most insidious in power over dynamics is that those who are powerless typically repeat the same behavior when the tables are turned and they are promoted into power. We see this in hazing rituals. We see it in the perpetuation of policies that do not support the disenfranchised. Why should I care about young working mothers when no one cared about me? The phrase power over is typically enough to send chills down spines.